I'm Christopher Light, and this is Open Source, the radio voice of a nonstop web conversation about all the books you can read and react to at radioopensource.org. This is the John Updike Hour with the author of a broad bookshelf of novels, stories, poetry, and criticism, the master of the writerly profession that we rely on. Terrorist, his post-9/11 meditation on America, is a departure. It's a pretty grim composite view of the U.S. from the immigrant working class, from the perspective of high school and furniture trucks, from the patched-up Jersey side of the bridges and tunnels into Manhattan, all of it framed by John Updike's reading of the Quran. Can you imagine growing seeds of mass-murdering terrorism in such ground? John Updike did. The way into our conversation is through the website, www.radioopensource.org. Welcome, John Updike. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Many voices, many views in this book, Terrorist, but in some degree, they're of a piece. It's a kind of Jersey dark view, almost equally dark from the view of Ahmad Asmawi Malloy, as from that of his guidance counselor or his boss in the furniture store, a Lebanese immigrant. Summarize the view and tell us if it's yours.
It did occur to me as I was writing this that Ahmad and Jack Levy do see the same sorts of things, although maybe they don't look at exactly the same thing. But the sense of America being run down and there being nowhere much to go, Jack Levy talks about America as sort of drowning in its own fat, and it's like a big tar baby. And as to Charlie, yes, he takes a somewhat more gleeful view of what might seem like a kind of dead-end consumerist society with very little to offer its young people, no ideals, not many jobs. So yes, you could say it's a dark view, although life goes on in places like New Prospect, and the people are meant to have happy moments and bright moments and even some aspirations.
I don't want to overdo the grimness of it. Life is always sort of tough, but Ahmad looks around. He says, I look around me and I see slaves, slaves to drugs, slaves to fad, slaves to television, slaves to sports heroes that don't know they exist, slaves to the unholy, meaningless opinions of others. Goes on like this.
Well, yes, it's all not untrue. Maybe it's not the only truth about it, but sure, I think we have become a very entertainment and celebrity conscious society at the cost of thinking things through or looking around us and trying to meditate. I don't know. But I think the entertainment craze is basically discouraging, although I guess I'm part of it. I'm trying to produce a sort of entertainment here myself.
It's a different branch of the field. We should probably just introduce the main characters here. Ahmad is 18 years old, dun-colored Egyptian child, really a mother's child of a nurse's aide, painter. But he's the protagonist, and we watch him to see where it leads. Jack Levy is his guidance counselor, kind of embittered, public school veteran, married to an enormously fat devotee of daytime television. And then Charlie is the entrepreneur. Among them, then throw in Sheikh Rashid, the imam, the instructor, and we have the ingredients of either a terrible explosion or some kind of enlightenment. What are we driving toward here?
Well, it's hard to reconstruct what you exactly had in mind. This is a kind of vision, and it was based upon visits I made to Paterson, New Jersey, about 15 years ago when I was researching old Paterson, the Paterson of 1910, which was full of industry and full of immigrants and full of forward motion. And now the forward motion is pretty well stopped, and Paterson is almost a classic example of a stalled city with an empty downtown and a lot of the people on welfare. And nevertheless, there was a kind of carnival feeling as I remember Paterson, so I hope I did some justice to that. Jack Levy, for example, goes to a high school graduation and is moved to tears, actually, by in all this urban urban despair. There are these hopeful kids getting their degrees and trying to play by the rules and trying to figure out a future for themselves.
And yet, it's not a good prospect. Ahmad at one point says he feels the mild pity owed to a failed experiment looking at our country. And Jack pretty much says the same.
Yes, well, you can't take these people too seriously. Look at Charlie. He sees a lot of hope and energy here and says we're a very energetic country and can't be written off. Ahmad's views are very much those of his imam. He began to go to the mosque when he was 11. He was sort of a self-converted child. His father was an Egyptian who, when he was age 3, vanished and deserted him. So he has this void in his life he's trying to fill. Islam, to some extent, fills it. So he goes to the imam. He's a bit of a substitute father. And then Jack volunteers to be a substitute father. At first rejected, but later finally somewhat accepted. And of course, Charlie is his buddy and a fellow Muslim.
Charlie's kind of a big brother, too. There's a wonderful passage. Charlie is an immigrant who's fallen in love with New Jersey history and the Revolutionary War. I mean, he's been reading up, and he's talking to young Ahmad about Valley Forge and explaining that they might have starved out there in the war. And Ahmad says to Charlie, for the state of the world now, it might have been better if they had. The United States might have become a kind of Canada, a peaceable and sensible country, though infidel. And then Charlie comes right back. Dream on, he says. There's too much energy here for peace and sensible. Contending
right.
Energies. That's what the Constitution allows for.
Yes, I remember that remark of Ahmad's took me slightly by surprise, that suddenly preferring Canada, a nice, peaceable country, to the United States. His view, the boy's 18-year-old devout boy's view of the culture around him in the high school, is pretty horrified because he sees all these girls exposing pieces of themselves and tattoos and rings and everything that the Quran condemns, is there. So he sees a sex-obsessed society and very flashy goals of passing entertainment and all the rest of it. So yes, there's much in the United States to repel and horrify him. But not me so much. I'm not Ahmad exactly, although I can maybe imagine what he would think.
But this is where it gets interesting, if I may say, John Updike. I kept thinking of the young John Updike growing up in Pennsylvania, besotted 50-odd years ago with James Thurber and Ted Williams in the 40s and 50s. And I thought, you know, is that young man grown to fame and maturity as appalled by this country as Ahmad is?
No, but I think Ahmad's point of view is understandable. And certainly in a city like New Prospect, it's a long way from Shillington, PA. Shillington, PA in the 40s and 50s was not exactly a picture book small town, but it was a very pleasant, relaxed, cozy, friendly place to be. It was not diverse either, I'll point out, very undiverse. So in some ways it was a kind of a pocket, and I, as a school teacher's child, was additionally sheltered. I was enabled to dream these dreams, not so much of being like Ted Williams, I gave up on that fairly early, but of being like James Thurber or some other writer, some humorous writer. I wanted to be a humorous writer and make people laugh.
But, you know, as I read this book, it reminded me of my own, just a moment on the day of 9/11, picking up the New Yorker magazine, your favorite magazine and mine too. But reading those Prada ads and looking at those models and thinking, wait a sec, there is something. Suddenly you can see that culture from Ahmad's eyes. I could see it then. Interestingly enough, we discovered just in those biographies of all the people who died in those buildings, another New York, a much plainer, harder, tougher, younger, immigrant, scrappy, different New York. But there is something decadent in that culture that we all live on too easily. And it seems to me your book is, we can all agree, sort of, with this perspective?
Well, also the TV, television, it gives you the news, and some of it's pretty grim. In fact, some of it is very grim. It seems that there's a suicide bombing every day, and even the death of al-Zarqawi isn't somehow soothing, that is, to bomb a man to death in this brutal way. So, yeah, it's a tough... A tough sell on TV news, but it doesn't stop them from running these ads, more or less saying that if you drink enough Coke, girls will flock to you, and all manner of, I guess they've cut out the Viagra and the Cialis ads, but that was a rich mix for a while. So yeah, on the one hand, we're being appealed to as consumers, as people who want more and more. On the other hand, we're being told that the world is going to hell in a handbasket.
And your guy, Charlie Chehab, says, the Lebanese furniture guy, says what we could pretty much all say. He's teaching Ahmad about the corruption of this television. Although he'd love to make commercials himself. He says, the news is sob sister stuff, Diane Sawyer, the poor Afghani babies, boo-hoo-hoo, or else straight propaganda. But it's worse here than the Kremlin ever was. It's subtler. The commies just wanted to brainwash you. The new powers that be, the international corporations, want to wash your brains away, period. That should be done with a Lebanese accent. But isn't it you? Isn't it all of us?
I thought your accent was terrific. sure. But these people are people in a novel, and they're expressing exaggerated and unqualified views. I think it is true that the ideal consumer, I once read a nice article about the chicken coop society, that what the manufacturers would like would have people in their little coops just buying and buying, and that's all they do. And it's a kind of a ghastly image. Yes.
When we come back, I want you to explain how you educated yourself on behalf of all of us, really, in the Quran. Although I'm still wondering whether television in this book isn't sort of our Quran, you know, five times a day, something like worship. We're talking with John Updike about his novel Terrorist. This is Open Source. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Brendan. I'm the Open Source Blogger in Chief. Thursday is Blogs Day, the one-year anniversary of an experiment that actually worked. We will read on-air excerpts from blog posts that together give us a picture of one day in the blogosphere. We want your help. We are gathering posts from Tuesday, June 6th, and we're looking for anything. Recipes, love sickness, dog blogs, solitary reflections from a BlackBerry in a car parked by the side of the road. If you actually find one of those, we will be grateful. Post it to radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. John Updike is our guest, the novelist in his 22nd at-bat in the novel form is called Terrorist. It's about a young man growing up, born in America, growing up in New Jersey, in love with the Quran and gravely tempted by an act of extreme terrorism. Can we talk about the Quran? First of all, I have to say you do what we should all be doing, is reading these world documents that figure in everything now. What did you learn? And how did you do it?
Well, you know, I once in my 30s was quite interested in reading about world religions, and I read the Bhagavad Gita and various Buddhist texts, and I don't think I read the Quran through in that case, but I tried to acquaint myself with what the other great religious traditions are, what they say that we say and what they say that we don't say. I read the Quran through when I wrote a book called The Coup, which again was about a radical Islamist, based more and more on Colonel Gaddafi than who's sort of faded now. He's almost a buddy of ours, so it just goes to show that what goes around comes around. But at any rate, when I came to write this book and wanted to write about a young devout terroristic recruit, I looked around into it again. I was especially concerned to see how often the Prophet enjoined his followers to combat or exterminate the infidels. And although this isn't all that's in the Quran, there is quite a lot of it rather alarmingly, so that the insurgents and the other people who quote the Quran aren't just quoting nothing. They're not making it up. Idolatry is worse than carnage is yes. One quote that I remember.
That's sort of the decisive phrase for him when he decides to plunge. You know, better they should die.
Yes, and in the critical crisis scene, which I'll try not to give away, his interlocutor says, why do you want to kill so many innocent people? And Ahmad says, who says that unbelievers are innocent? Unbelievers say that. So, yes, it's a stark view. But
he argues with his teacher about just how literal these expressions are. And, of course, he knows well the loving, light side of the Quran, too.
He feels God's presence as quite real, as sort of like a brother who's right there. There's a Quranic verse about God is as close as the vein in your neck. Mm. And so he feels that vein and turns in prayer to almost another self. And at some point, I think I liken it to the two pages of the same book. That is, one is obverse, one is reverse, but... Yes, he feels God's benign and counseling presence quite keenly. On the other hand, he does encounter these many harsh and stark verses in the Quran. And it's not just the Quran, it's also the hadith, the tradition of things that Muhammad reputedly said, the 72 virgins that are promised to the martyr. Are in fact not in the Quran at all, but they are in the hadith, the sayings of Muhammad.
But young Ahmed is sophisticated enough to discount the literalism of that promise too.
He does not contemplate death as being a marriage to the 72 virgins, as many insurgents and suicide bombers do. No, but he does see it as coming face to face with God, which he expects to be a thoroughly pleasant and blissful experience.
Okay, three quick questions here, or serious questions. One, did you presume some in getting to know the Quran? Is it knowable? Second question, who says that the real driver in this young man's life is religion as opposed to politics, say? And equally, in the insurgency in Iraq, how do we know what part of this confrontation is religious? How much of it is oil or ownership or manhood? And then third, we've got to get to the question of how like and how different this young man's experience of the Quran is from yours or mine or many other Christians grappling with our book. But start with the matter of, you know, have you mastered it?
I have not mastered the Quran. In fact, I've received on other radio shows, I've been told that I have no business writing about the Quran at all because I don't know Arabic. But, You know, I wrote about Jews without knowing Hebrew either, so I figured that a novelist has to learn a certain amount and then take a leap into what he thinks will be the case.
Kafka wrote about, you know, cockroaches without knowing
Yes, you wrote about America. You wrote about America without ever coming here. So okay. You must give a novelist a blank check. As long as he can be persuasive and entertaining, you mustn't hold him too much to. But yes, of course, the language is apparently very seductive. I remember one time I was in Cairo. Actually, I've been in Cairo a couple times. But the call of the muezzins to prayer at night pierces you, and the language does things that English does not. It twists the soul. So I can believe that there's poetry in the Quran which does not come through into any English translation. Nevertheless, when so much talk is in the air now about Islam, I thought it was the least I could do and try to acquaint myself with the Quran. And I was helped with an advisor who Harvard found for me, a graduate student in Arabic, who tried to keep my Arabic, when I quote it, on the straight path, as it were.
You transcribe a lot of it, or you transliterate it, and you seem to be in love with the sound of it.
Yes, it's very easy to find Qurans in Arabic script, and it's pretty easy to find them in English translation, but it's hard to find them in transliteration into the Roman alphabet, and yet that's what I thought would give a flavor of the language itself, and also serve to portray a Quran lesson, which is what Ahmad, I think we see him twice actually trying to learn the Quran and dueling with his rather sardonic and mysterious and gorgeous imam. Your second question, I'm trying to remember now. Yes?
Who says that what's really driving this young boy is religion, as opposed to, let us say, a search for his Arab manhood or his maybe American manhood?
Well, they pretty much say it. And if you look at the 19 men who pulled off the World Trade Center bombings, many of them, especially Muhammad Atta, the leader, left wills full of pious terminology and so on, and they did the ablutions and tried to make themselves pure because they know they were going to their death. And in their own terms, they've framed death as being a wonderful thing.
They also went to a strip club.
And they couldn't do this without without religion in a big way. Yes, I'm sorry. You
said, well, no, I was going to say they also went to a strip club on the way to their end.
Curious, yes, and he drank apparently. I read that with some interest that he was an unruly customer in a Florida strip joint.
Well, I pushed the question because you have two mentors in the direction of terror over Ahmad. One is his Islamic teacher, and the other is this very cynical Charlie Chihab, who's full of grievance about Middle Eastern politics, and including the war in Iraq, and is not a believer of any kind, as far as we can make out. But one of Ahmad's coaches is religious, the other is political. And I wondered, were you finessing the choice there, or is it both? Is it a mix?
I don't think Ahmad is very political, although he mouths the correct slogans, the Zionist devils and things like that. But I take him to be basically a study in religious belief and conviction. The book begins with his fear that these devils, as he thinks of all the Americans around him, these devils are trying to take my God from me. I'm not denying that there is an element of political protest in a lot of the insurgency, and of course nobody likes to be occupied as they perceive it. But it seems to me what makes them so fierce and makes them so fertile in keep popping up is the religion. Islam has always been fierce in its belief system, has not had anything like the Victorian retrenchment. There is no higher criticism in Islam, as far as I know, or if there is, the professors are on the outs with the radicals. So it's hard for an American to believe that people take their religion as seriously and as absolutely as this is so, exactly so, and off we go.
Next question The third question had to do with the Christian correspondences and not, including that business of activism. I know, I mean, in my time in college, they were the Opus Dei Catholics who took you, you know, inhaled it all and wanted to live their lives around the doctrine. This was pre-Da Vinci Code, obviously. But it's hard to imagine a Christian of the sort I grew up with who would have been moved to action. It might have been moved to monasteries or lives of prayer. But in any event, I'm wondering, what is the difference in Ahmad from the experience you had as a young man, and you've written about eloquently a number of times, of a young man trying to get square with his maker?
And to hold on to his belief. Right. Yes, of course. And there are a number of analogies here with Christian faith. And indeed, Ahmad is somewhat susceptible. He goes to a Baptist church in pursuit of his, the closest he comes to a girlfriend, and is somewhat, despite himself, moved. So he is religiously susceptible. I think the difference might be, one difference might be that Islam, since about 1100 or so, has been kind of a loser. It's certainly been a loser in the very era when Christian imperialism exerted its spell over the entire world. So you have winners and losers, and I think the losers maybe are apt to cling more fiercely to their creed, just a guess. But certainly the sense of resentment and rage that comes out of the Islamic world can be explained only as the expression of a frustration that things aren't better for them. As to oil, no doubt it's part of the strategy that got us there in the first place, but I don't know how much it figures in their thinking. I just have not encountered in the newspapers too many leaders of the insurgency, either in Palestine or Iraq, who do not take a religious line. It seems to be quite essential in what makes them formidable and implacable.
I'd have to say I'm much more uncertain about it and confused. They seem to be quite different. Does Zarqawi have a religious drive? Do the Toronto plotters have a primarily religious drive? I find it very problematic to say what's the main engine here.
In any warrior group, there's solidarity, I think, as a unifying principle. We've learned that, or the studies of GIs in our wars, that they basically weren't fighting for flag or country or even apple pie and the girl back home, but they're fighting for their buddies. And no doubt the Iraqi insurgents were also fighting for their buddies. But Zarqawi did voice his victims pretty much in religious terms. And what the people in Toronto think, an interesting example of homegrown terrorism, because that's what my book is really about. My book isn't about us versus those Arabs over there, but it's about the possibility of young men in this country being attracted to an ideology so fierce and absolute and romantic in a way and attractive, therefore.
Brendan Greeley, our blogger-in-chief, minds the blog store. Brendan, what's up?
Well, while we're talking about homegrown terrorism, we have a comment from this afternoon from Zeke317. I'm just going to read it out loud. Since he's a longtime observer of the American scene, I would be interested in Mr. Updike's view on whether there are aspects of his terrorist that are comparable to other homegrown terrorists like Timothy McVeigh.
Oh, I would say so. McVeigh is a great example, and he was in my mind. Indeed, he's mentioned in the book. And also this John Walker out there, the white Taliban member from California. In the wake of 9/11, there was a young man in Florida, I think, who drove a Piper Cub or something into a smaller skyscraper. So, yes, imitation will happen. And all these people were in some ways drawn to the purity, let's say the purity of the Islamic extreme.
John, could we talk about television in this book and in our culture as a kind of Quran? It is played for laughs in a certain way, but it's I put the question sort of seriously. Is there a correspondence? Jack Levy's wife is watching television all the time, and you make up some marvelous lines out of punitive.
Let's hope.
daytime television, including a line I love, somebody on the television says, you've got to love yourself enough to walk away from that man. Let your mother have him if that's what she wants. They deserve each other. She's eating her cookies and ingesting this culture. Is this sort of the ultimate degradation of a religious text?
The TV serials, which I watched a little just to be, you know, to get better into Beth's head, do involve these convolutions of relationship and, you know, falling in love, seducing, the mother seducing the daughter's boyfriend and all that. It occurs. And I wonder if it isn't the result of a commitment to hedonism, which this country has made. And here you see the tangle that the polymorphous perverse, in a way, operates in these TV dramas. And there's a certain zombie-like quality that especially the male actors, the young male actors, have a kind of a stare they get, and the tingly music in the background. It's kind of another world, or one step beyond the world we're in. I once wrote a whole novel based on the thesis that the movies had replaced religion in this country. It's hard for me to not being TV religious, the way that I was movie religious. It's hard to me to believe it's a religion, but it certainly is a kind of a dope which we take whenever we're tired and want to relax, and you turn it on and there's this friendly face or faces in the room with you. So it's become a great reliever, in a way, of some of our angst. You turn it on and mindlessly watch it and finally fall asleep.
Certainly Beth does. Has it peaked? Is the activism of the internet and the web relieving it some, or?
It seems to, I would guess it is. I don't know, I can't, there's a limit to which I can think. I think like an 18-year-old now, but it would seem that, yeah, the interactive quality and the sort of do-it-yourself quality of the internet is more appealing than the passive ingestion of the television world.
May I presume to say, I think there's a gap in the book, John Updike, in that we never hear Bush Kerry even up to September 2004. There was a presidential campaign going on in the background of this novel. Fallujah was also getting ripe for, you know, destruction at the same time. Did that belong in the book or not?
I thought I did allude a bit to the campaign going on, but my sense of New Prospect is that the political campaigns don't carry very far down into its population, that it's all something happens out there, up there, and that those people don't really think their situation is going to be better or worse if Kerry or Bush is in power. I could be wrong, but you're right, it's not there. There's a lot of things that are not there, because this was a kind of a visionary novel, and in some extent, I was young when it was much simpler world, so maybe I made the world a little simpler than it really is.
It's a fascinating statement, though, that Bush, Kerry, just two guys from Skull and Bones at Yale, who cares, right?
Oh, they cared. They wanted to win, as we all do once we've embarked upon a contest. But almost half the people in this country don't vote. And what a remarkable statement that is. All the TV commercials, all the drum beating, all the pundits going on and on in the newspapers don't stir half the population to trouble to vote.
John Updike is our guest. His novel is called Terrorist. It's, to me, the completest, most gripping of the post 9/11 novels I've read. We're going to talk about other books too when we come back. This is Open Source from PRI.
Thank you.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source with the novelist John Updike. Same man as the critic, the reader, the discoverer of writers, John Updike. Our favorite reviewer, in fact. I'd love to talk with you, John, about sort of the post-imperial literature being written, but all the stuff that's not being written, too. I'm just recently hooked on the fact that 100 years ago, I mean, say 1906, was a tremendous time for an anti-imperial movement in American as well as British literature, about the Boer War, about the American acquisition or seizure of the Philippines and Cuba. Mark Twain maybe was the leading writer. Jack London also. William Dean Howells also, great Bostonian. George Bernard Shaw and others. Arthur Conan Doyle went and covered and wrote a definitive history of the Boer War. It also strikes me that the Iraq War begins to sound more and more like our Boer War. But the question is, where is the 21st century literature of our place in the world? Obviously, Kipling was at a peak, you know, maybe 1906, too. But where do we look in our literature and other people's literature for that novel guide to us on the great globe?
I think that when Twain and Shaw and others, Howells, were raising their voices against the imperial trends that had been pervasive through the 19th century, they were taking a somewhat radical and even original stance. I think for any writer now to take an anti-imperialist stance is to create a lot of ho-hum, because what writer is not somewhat to the left? What writer is not going to deplore the bloodshed and the messiness and the apparent futility in the Iraq operation? So I don't know if you'll find a strict analogy anywhere. Maybe the more daring voices were those who were raised in the 50s against the American imperium as it then existed.
Who are you thinking about?
Well, Mailer, I guess, and in their way, the Beats and Pynchon. You could say that Don DeLillo is something of a radical thinker and dramatizer along these lines. But there's a danger of taking too overtly political a stance when you become just one more orator. I think the fiction writer really just tries to understand the problem and to sympathize with various aspects or various embodiments of the problem rather than... I did write a kind of anti-American imperial book in The Coup because it was about the basic futility of the American efforts to influence the so-called Third World. It seemed to me that America was powerful in what it exported in the jazz, in the movies, in the very style of freedom, the very clothes of freedom. Mm-hmm. We're all American. All had made in America, made on their lapels and on their labels, and that was where we really were influencing the world and the credit card. And listen, I don't think the political or foreign policy behavior is near as important or successful, really.
Well, I want to argue a little bit with you. It seems to me that there was a moment just before 9/11. Zadie Smith's White Teeth may have been the best example, but of a very explicitly hybridized model being launched. She being half Jamaican, half British, but her characters in White Teeth were the same. And the book kind of announced we've entered a hybridizing century. And it was also a time in which, you know, people like Salman Rushdie or the variety of Caribbean, African, Indian writers, Ishiguro and others were getting us used to sort of a globalized culture, a globalized literature, highly varied and interesting, but sort of one world. 9/11 drew lines again. And it seemed to me it rather silenced all those energetic post-colonial, post-imperial messages that that I'd come to like, and I still think maybe back. Where are they today?
Zadie Smith continues to write rather successfully. You can't keep writing white teeth over and over again.
That's true.
She's maturing and maybe sees new things. Salman Rushdie, I'm one of the relatively few people who read, what was it called? Oh, The Clown, Shalimar the Clown. And that was all about Kashmir and Indians and turning men into robots and evil imams. And it was sort of a lot of the works that you might expect in a portrait of the world as it is, of the melting together, troubled, bedeviled. World. I used to read a lot of African fiction of the 60s when there was great hope for the post-colonial African world and voices, and they did have a new way of writing novels, some of them, and there were some brilliant novels, but I don't see that much now. It seems to me that post-colonialism in Africa has just run into very sad soil, AIDS, corruption, general lassitude, really. Just when you pronounce some segment of the arts dead, it springs to life. Who would have thought that a great novelist like Proust would come out of a very decadent world, the dying world of the French aristocracy, nevertheless produce this masterpiece?
But is that a metaphor of the whole world, a kind of collapse of hope and expectation from the liberated former colonies? I mean, are we going to have to live with a sort of cultural hyperpower as we do with a military hyperpower? And I keep wondering whether, you know, the brown and black world is going to let us get away with it. Why should they? Why should they go back to that cage?
Well, are they going back? I think that there's always young people. Yes, they come up. They're produced. People still mate and make babies. And I don't think the young brown and black people are quite as concerned with scoring off of the white world. There's enough of them in this country and elsewhere that they maybe don't feel that they need to plead their own case. I would hope so, at any rate, and that the actual assimilation is spoken of by their relative, or what seems to you to be a silence.
I always look to your reviews in The New Yorker for a kind of eye for the future, Brother Houellebecq and so many others. Where do you see a kind of alternatives to this American voice that I think even you are sated with somehow?
I've never asked to review American fiction. I find most of it a lot of it sort of overbearing and self-conscious and trying too hard. So that the experimental fiction of Europe and of Latin America was, in my reviewing prime, what I really cared about, because I was hoping to learn new ways to tell a story, and indeed what is a story and what is worth telling and those other riddles that beset the novelist. Right now, I don't think American literary culture is going to sweep the world, really. But what will sweep the literary world, and is the literary world worth talking about, even in such an electronic age when the internet is threatening to gobble up the very idea of a copyright in a bookstore?
Well, the internet is also trying to open us up to all of those new voices out there. Property claims will come later. I wonder, I so admire your immersion in the homework you did for this book. Do you feel closer to the inner life of Muslims and Arabs, particularly, at the end of this process?
Yes, I did. I did. Although I obviously went into the book knowing I was going to try to write from the inside of a terrorist and a young man converted to terrorism. At the same time, the longer I inhabited him, the more at home I somehow felt in his head. He may be a bit of a phantom. Some of the critics have found him very unreal, and there was something rather stately or stiff about the way he talked. I took that to be an echo of the imam's rather stately Quranic or neo-Quranic diction. I imagine that I can see how how those suicide bombers feel in Palestine as they... And the mothers who say they feel no sorrow, that they're proud to have been the mother of a martyr, all this different way of looking at death and self-sacrifice has helped in me by the amount of reading and thinking I did.
Well, it helps us as readers. You're torn in the critical zone between people who think it's presumptuous for you to write from a Muslim Arab head, and at the same time people are knocking you for being a little too tender. It's only fair to say, it's important to say about this book, that it is very empathetic. It's very warm. You're very concerned, almost fatherly, with this boy.
That's right. I'm the missing father that he's looking for. I hadn't thought of that. It is true. I felt fatherly toward him and wanted him to succeed in his way. Yes, it made me. But you know, it's still horrendous acts are being perpetrated, and there's a kind of an insanity which is very frightening to those of us who think that civilization is a sort of a tender structure that ought to be nurtured and preserved. Because these people are in the state of mind now that any act of destruction is on their side a point. It wins, you know. So just tear down, bomb, any old fool thing, hospitals, schools. I don't think even the anarchists of the late 19th century were so fierce and so undiscriminating. Where will it end? But I do feel, after all, this book is an American book. It's about a young American, basically, and even if his Americanism takes the form of an Islamic fanaticism, he's still it's an American kind of fanaticism and an American kind of self-creation.
An American sort of blogger-in-chief, Brendan Greeley, is pulling at the leash there. Brendan?
Well, we found a Canadian blog, actually. A review was written of this book on a blog called My Tragic Right Hip. The writer's a woman, a Canadian with a brand new titanium hip. Seems to be a significant part of her identity. She writes, "What bothered me the most were the lack of truly redeeming female characters. Ahmad's mother was an artist who was not particularly prone to child rearing. His crush ends up being a hooker, and the two other characters, one is a spinster, the other an obese librarian." So this gives us a question. Is this a conscious part of Ahmad's world, the lack of redeeming female characters? Is this part of what puts him in the truck with a bomb?
Well, you see those women a little more harshly than I do. I think Jarlene is really a sweetheart, is making the best she can of her own romantic situation. I think that the mother is not the worst mother ever came into the world, and in many ways is what the psychiatrist called a good enough mother. But she was operating without a father there, which is really what the boy wanted. And as to the two sisters, they're each in their way trying to cope with middle age and its disappointments. They've come a long way from a childhood in Philadelphia that seemed to them idyllic. So I am surprised that you found them lacking in value. There may be a devil in me making them ridiculous or less worthy of admiration, but it's not a devil that I was aware of.
Brendan was speaking there for the blogger, not for himself. there's another, well, they're related questions. Have you sold the movie rights here? This felt like a movie, John.
You know, I was in Los Angeles and talked to the agent who handles them, and I asked him, and nobody has bitten. I don't know how you'd handle it, or indeed any book of mine in a movie, because there's some point at which a novel turns on itself and says, "Ha, reader, you expected this, didn't you? But now you're going to get that." And there is a twist, or I don't know. I think also my books are sort of too purely verbal. I wouldn't mind. I love the movies, but I don't think I write very well for them.
But the next question was, who plays Jack Levy? And it's also a way of saying, in some respects, he's the hero of this story, and he's the one who finds a redemptive surge of sympathy and activism.
Yes.
Out of this whole experience.
Courage. He shows courage. He's, I guess, a hero. Of course, he's an admirable person who, for all his fatigue and disappointment in life, he manages to care about this boy who otherwise is left to his own rather terrible devices.
But it's almost more than that. This is a played-out civil servant in despair about his own his own faith, his own country, his own career. His own son has gone out west and lost interest entirely in his roots. He's in despair about his marriage too, and yet he sees something in this boy worth sticking his neck out for in a very big way.
Jack Levy, even to the mismatching suit coat and trousers, is sort of a version of my father, who was also a patient plotter and involved in school teaching. He was not a guidance counselor, but he taught each class as though he was a guidance counselor. So this book, really, when you think about it, it has a kind of rabbit in it in the form of Ahmad, a kind of a reckless guy on the move, operating out of gut instinct that God loves him. And then you have this centaur sort of figure, the plodding, horse-like, patient, dogged civil servant.
I hadn't thought of that.
No, I just did right now. I hadn't ever thought of it either. But it occurs to me that any writer has a few types, a few moral exemplars that he reverts to. And I may have reverted in this book to two of mine.
That's completely fascinating. And I didn't know that you could look over your own shoulder quite that clearly.
Well, when I was writing it, I wondered why a high school again when I've done a high school more than once. It's obviously one of the few American institutions that I feel I understand from inside. I don't understand business. Really, I hardly understand how a truck works, but I do understand a little bit about how high schools look from inside the standpoint of the teacher. It's an amazing thing. It's where Americans are made, yes, but at the same time, it's kind of a mob. It's this mob of people who would rather be elsewhere, slamming their locker doors while rapidly aging adults try to shepherd them toward some kind of a future.
You're unfair to yourself in the sense that I think of you as such a relentless researcher and always learning things, and in this case, I think you've made a real civic example of yourself.
I'm a researcher, Chris, who doesn't know much. I somehow have gone through life being a school teacher's innocent son, and I feel I've observed very little. I mean, much less than there is there to observe. So, in a way, I begin each book with almost a blank slate, and I have to read a few books to bone up on reality.
Well, I said on the page, I always remember you talking about how you halfway learned the cello in the course of writing The Witches of Eastwick. But you do the work, John Updike. Is the next one begun?
You know, I wonder if I'll ever write another one. I collected a lot of reviews and criticism. That's how I spent my time since I laid this book to rest. And so I have a book of criticism, another big book of that, and then a novel should occur beyond that if I have the energy and if I still think I have something more to say. But maybe I've sung my little song now. 22 novels. 22 novels is more than Henry James wrote.
He wrote 20. I know. I thought of that. Isn't that interesting? You thought of it, too. Thank you, John Updike. It's always a pleasure. And we love this book.
Well, thank you.
Terrorist. $29.95 or something. Cheap at twice the price.
$24.95.
I'm sorry. What's the difference? You can keep talking about Terrorist. You can help us work on the next shows at radioopensource.org. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support Physicians for Human Rights, promoting health by protecting human rights, www.phrusa.org. Our show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Murs, and Robin Amer. Our closing music was provided by Gerardor Zero. Robin Moore is our engineer. Mary McGrath's our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon.
PRI, Public Radio International.